So in today's Mushroom Podcast, we're talking to Dr. Mark Loftus from Sylvan Spawn Company. Hello, Mark.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you. I thought we might start off by talking a little bit about your background and what you do for Sylvan and how a Manchester lad has ended up working in the US, and then cover some of the things that you spoke about at the recent ISMS conference in terms of breeding of agaricus. So tell us the story of your life.
You have the big red book with you. This is your life.
I might.
So anyway, I did a degree in Wales, Aberystwyth, bachelor's degree, and then I went to do a PhD at Manchester in the north of England. The PhD was on RFLPs, which are the special DNA markers for spotting different genotypes. So I did that. Then I did a two-year postdoc in human genetics, which was a mistake. You know, I wanted to stay in Manchester because my friends were all there, which is a terrible reason.
Yeah.
So I then got off and out of the blue, a two-year postdoc at UC Santa Barbara in California. And I was there for 2 years. And then I got offered a permanent job to join MSL on the West Coast in the Monterey Bay area, which was very nice. And I embarked on a career in mushroom breeding.
So that was your first encounter with breeding mushrooms.
That's absolutely correct.
So yep. Before that, you'd just been working on human molecular work.
Genetics, and then I did human, and I went back to Santa Barbara, back to mushrooms again, but a different kind of mushroom. Is a model mushroom called Coprinus. Okay, so I did 11 years in California, and then I decided to explore new opportunities, and I ended up in Pennsylvania at Lambert, which is a terrific family-owned business, and I was there for another 11 years, and I joined Sylvan 11 years ago.
There's a pattern that's emerging here.
Yeah, there is, yeah. But I'm going to stay longer than 11 years. I'm in charge of white breeding, which is the white mushroom varieties. And we have a lab in France where Dr. Anissa Amini, she does the brown breeding.
Okay.
So we can split things up. Anissa also does shiitake and pleurotus as well. In Sylvan, we're working Kittanning, which is about 38 miles north of Pittsburgh. It's due north of Pittsburgh in the very western fringe of Pennsylvania. It's in what they call the Rust Belt. So it's a very unfashionable area to move to, but the lab is well equipped and I have wonderful colleagues and I enjoy the challenge.
So you're reasonably close to where, you know, the centre of mushroom production in the US, at least a couple of hours away, right?
It's more like five, to be honest with you.
Five.
It's a good place to have a spawn plant because Ontario is another big mushroom growing area in Canada. And we can halfway in between Ontario and southeast Pennsylvania. So it's a good hub.
Yeah. So mushroom breeding is probably even more challenging than plant and animal breeding in many ways. Like the complexity of the mushroom genome and difficulty of separating out, what are they called? Maybe you could... It's not my area, so maybe...
Very well, Jenny. So we collect spores and there are a low percentage of spores which have got half the number of chromosomes. They're called haploids or homokaryons. Mm-hmm. And we got really good molecular markers. We can collect many of those and you cross homokaryons with one another to make heterokaryons. And a heterokaryon is a diploid culture capable of making mushrooms.
And with different genetic properties, right? So those homokaryons, they're quite rare though, aren't they? You need to do a lot of single spore cultures in order to get one or two homokaryons, is that correct?
In the literature, it sounds like that, but in fact, it's a lot easier than it sounds. You just develop, we use a microscope, we look at the cultures on a petri plate, and we pick the slow growing ones out And when you get down at the microscopic level, you can see the branching patterns different. Generally speaking, Homo carians are slower growing. And if you enrich for slower growing cultures and then test with DNA markers, you can have hundreds of Homo carians. And bottleneck isn't collecting Homo carians, it's testing them, because testing is very specialized, very unusual, the way we test for crosses.
So how you're determining the genetic profile of those homokaryons, and so which ones would be good to try to hybridize?
Well, you've got markers for gender. We know that obviously there's two genders in humans. There's actually 12 in mushrooms. 12.
12?
Yeah. There's four
That's
in common.
crazy.
Yeah. And the Pleurotus has got hundreds and probably thousands of different genders. Shiitake does too. It's
Good
just
grief.
so, yeah.
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 Wow. So if you're a mushroom, you've got a good chance of a date on a Saturday night.
I think so. Yeah, you're not going to be alone very long. Yeah. But like I was saying, Jenny, the bottleneck is testing. It's expensive. You need compost, you need small containers, you need to fruit them. Then you need to evaluate them over, we go through five cycles of screening. We go from, let me think about this. It used to be we'd screen 1,000 and get two or three elite strains. Now we screen 1,000, we get a much larger number because our molecular tools have improved, our ability to select has improved. And I won't bore you with the details. Some of them are actually proprietary, but we can greatly improve our efficiencies by using DNA markers.
So once you've got those homokaryon strains and you've screened them, you can keep those more or less in perpetuity. Is that, or yeah? So you're increasing the library all the time.
Yes, yeah, we keep really good ones in liquid nitrogen, yeah. But we're always crossing new genotypes. We want to establish several different lineages of elite breeding stocks that are largely unrelated to one another, because we want to avoid inbreeding. That's another
So
thing with markers. You can avoid inbreeding effects. Beforehand, stuff was second and third cousins, and we had no idea.
you don't get a vigorous mushroom out of that one. You might get one with two double heads.
Yeah, we joke about West Virginia here. We say, well, that's the kind of stuff that goes on in West Virginia. Yeah.
So that's conventional breeding. What are the targets of that? Like, what qualities are you looking for in a new strain?
Well, that's a good question. It's driven by customers and largely by sales, because they're the people that interact with the customers. So we, for example, with Browns, we have an exciting new strain, which you may get to see in Australia. It sizes up really well, so you get a bigger, beefier portobello mushroom. So that's one of the things that we select for that's for Browns. For whites, we typically look for quality. We look for whiteness. We look for smoothness. We look for resistant bruising. And we look for, actually, the big one is piece weight.
Peace weight.
Yeah, the cost of picking mushrooms has gone up. So if you pick fewer mushrooms to a kilo, you're more efficient.
So a denser mushroom.
Yeah. So there's
Yeah.
a migration towards picking fewer, larger
Right.
mushrooms. Yeah.
So don't you just add calcium to improve that?
Well, actually, well, I could talk a lot about calcium. Yes, you could do. Calcium is almost like a hormonal thing for mushrooms.
How is it like a hormone?
It coats its mycelium with calcium oxalate crystals. If you ever look at it down a microscope, mycelium, on growing in compost or on a plate, accumulates calcium oxalate. And if you do studies, if you grow it on like a casing spawn, the more calcium you put in, up to a point, the happier the mycelium will be, the faster it will grow.
Is that right?
That's really strange, but it just is.
Well, I mean, I find the whole calcium thing is very
Yeah.
interesting. The problem is getting enough calcium into the actual mycelia and into the mushroom,
Yeah.
the fruiting body.
Yeah.
So, Are these strains that are denser, are they transporting calcium more
I
efficiently?
don't know. I mean, most of the weight is water. It's water weight. But honestly, I really don't know. It's going to be expensive to get into that and really see what's going on. That really is a university type project. It's not for us. But what we can do is we can select for the types which have improved density.
If they've got improved density, I'm guessing they're going to have better post-harvest storage life too.
Yes, they generally go together. Yeah. I say general. I don't want you to say that, that there's this proven link, because there really isn't. But generally, if you pick fewer larger mushrooms, you'll get higher quality mushrooms. You won't get the CO2 effects. You'll get the veil stretching. You'll get better mushrooms.
Yeah, there's a very good correlation between density and post-harvest storage quality. So, yeah. Okay, so that's conventional, but then in your presentation you talk quite a bit about all transgenic mushrooms, RNA antisensing and CRISPR.
I almost said transgender mushrooms in the presentation, which has been interesting. So it's easy to get DNA into mushroom now. It was very difficult for a period of about 20 years, but Penn State, the late Professor Pete Romaine, discovered that you could use a bacterium called Agrobacterium, and you could get anything you like into the mushroom genome if you have the right construct. So there are people who can, they used to be called gene jockeys, people who can make a, you know all about that, make a construct out of various bits and pieces. At the time, there was considerable resistance to GMOs, and that's weakened a lot now. There's less resistance to genetically modified products and foods. So the needle's moving the other way now, but it could take, past my retirement.
I was surprised that you said there was still a lot of resistance in the US because I thought that people were pretty au fait. I mean, there's GMO tomatoes, there's apples, there's all canola, etc.
Yeah, well, it's field crops which are processed to animal, mostly to animal feed, or cotton to clothes and soy to, again, animal feed. Most of the food that goes directly into humans is not genetically modified yet. But it's 55% of the US crops are GMOs right now, and it goes up.
Oh, wow. And I think it has the opportunity of using less chemicals too, because I mean you mentioned BT and the potential to put BT, so a insecticide, natural insecticide, into mushrooms, as we do like all cotton pretty well has got Bacillus thuringiensis toxin in it. Could we do the same with mushrooms and thereby solve the problem of scarabs and phorids in one swipe?
It's been tried, people have tried to do that with mushrooms. We've always been a bit skittish because it's directly being ingested by people. Something else I should mention is it cost, the FlavorSaver tomato cost a ton of money in tests to show it was safe. So if you release a food, you're on the hook for millions of dollars in tests with the USDA and the FDA to show that it's safe, it's not going to poison people.
It's hard to show that something doesn't do anything.
Right. Well, it generally regarded as safe. That's right.
Like it's hard to prove a negative. You can prove that something does something, but it's hard to prove it doesn't do anything. So
We're
it's.
just covering the surface of this issue. There are, conferences about this stuff, books written on it. I think the ice is melting, but there's still a long way to go with it.
Well, I guess the thing that surprised me was that you said this was almost, this could be done pretty well routinely for mushrooms.
Well, transformation, yes. RNA interference, yes. That works too. CRISPR is a bit of a mess, really. It's because it was published in 2016 in the Scientific American. It was never peer reviewed, which is a very naughty thing to do if you're a scientist. If you're going to make some claims, write a paper so it can be evaluated, so other people can repeat your methods. Never happened. So the real breakthrough was in 2020 from the Three Gorges University in China, and they did it. The other thing, Jenny, is everyone's going for the same targets, the Browning genes, the polyphenol oxidase genes. We found when we did RNA interference, we created a culture that was a bit weak. It lost some of its edge. It was slower growing. The Three Gorges group found that their PPO4, polyphenol oxidase 4 transformant, was also sick and slow growing. So it's likely that the target everyone went for carries a lot of baggage with it. That it's if you knock the gene out, you can make the whole cell poorly.
So this is, I guess, the really interesting thing. You've got to almost the same point using very different genetic manipulation techniques, and yet the result is the same, that by knocking out those Browning enzymes, so it's mainly PPO3 and PPO4, I think, is it? Yeah, so they're the main enzymes responsible for Browning in white mushrooms. But you knock them out, and there are other unintended
Yes,
consequences
that's absolutely
doing
right.
that. Yeah. I mean, I might say, like, many years ago, I worked on a melons that were antisense for ACC oxidase. So they didn't ripen unless you expose them to ethylene. But then they also didn't get chilling injury, but they didn't develop the same flavor profiles, and they didn't, there were all these other attributes of them that changed, even though you thought you'd only changed one thing.
Yes,
So
you're right.
is mushrooms, is it, it's a little bit the same. So you can change one thing, but who knows?
Well, I got to say, we're a private company, and we're probably never going to publish that in a journal because we don't have the bandwidth to go off and write papers. But I'm sure somebody else will discover the same thing and write it up. I think that Three Gorges University, they're a paper and a patent, and it's really good stuff. They did some good research there. So I think for CRISPR, we're going to be looking at other targets. And the other issue with CRISPR is that we've got a heterokaryon in agaricus, which means that in a fertile mycelium, a mature mycelium with two nucleotypes in, the number of nuclei in a cell can be anywhere from 2 to 50 in a cell. So if you
That is extraordinary.
CRISPR a couple of those nuclei, you've got a soup. You want to, it's very difficult. Once you do your editing, it's really difficult to get the edited nuclei back out. There are some methods that we're testing at the moment that I don't want to get into here. There are theoretical ways of doing that, but it's if you do it with Pleurotus or Shiitake, Lentinula now, it's a rigid dikaryon, so the genetics it's less messy, and it's easier to handle. There's a very, very good presentation by Professor Honda from Japan on Pleurotus in Las Vegas, and he didn't have any problems. He just worked really well, and that's because his system is simpler and easier to use than boring old agaricus.
So maybe we should just step back a moment and explain what CRISPR is and how it's different to GMO, because CRISPR nominally is not a genetically modified organism, according to the US and according to Australia, in
Yes,
fact.
that's right. Yeah. Well,
So how is it different?
GMO, you're putting a load of foreign information into a cell, and part of that package can be the CRISPR genes, which is an enzyme and a kind of guide RNA. But if you take that through meiosis, if you in a in a plant, if you collect seeds or spores in a mushroom, you can get, theoretically, you can get the you can remove the foreign piece of DNA and just end up with just through random assortment, just get a nucleus with the edit, nothing else. Okay, so that's one way of doing it. The other way is these RNPs, which are ribonuclear proteins. There's no foreign DNA there, it's something you inject. The problem with that method is there's no reporter. It's very difficult to tell which cells are edited and which aren't. So it needs a lot more technical savvy to get that to work. There are ways of getting crisper editing without it being a GMO. You're absolutely right.
And CRISPR only uses the genes which are already in the animal, plant, fungus. It's not introducing them from another organism. Is that correct?
I think I know what you're saying, but I mean to clarify, the fungi don't have a CRISPR, a gene editing system. It comes from bacteria. It's a virus defense system actually in bacteria, and it's very simple. And it uses a little piece of RNA to detect a foreign intruder, and then it obliterates the where the intruder has landed in the genome. We can borrow that from bacteria and get it to work in pretty much any system that we choose to. And as you said just now, Jenny, you don't want it to be a true GMO. It's a lot easier if you've just got the edit and nothing else.
Well, that would be more acceptable to regulators. You won't have to do that extensive consumer testing to show that they're not
No,
poisonous.
absolutely right. No, with if you we use Agrobacterium, and it's theoretically possible to just take it through meiosis and just have your edit, nothing else. But no one's published that yet, but it's theoretically it's possible. And the plant world, they've used that successfully. Do you know the people who are driving the bus here is American big ag. It's Corteva and Bayer. Used to be Monsanto. They're spending a huge amount of money on transgenic crops, and they're heavily getting into CRISPR. So we're small potatoes compared to them.
So, do you think this is the future of mushroom breeding, is through those more molecular techniques rather than conventional breeding?
Well, that's a key question. I think if you look at the next 5 to 10 years, I think it's going to be the there are going to be new hybrid mushroom spawns from ourselves and our competitors, and they'll be created using the same toolbox, which doesn't involve CRISPR. But beyond that, I think the techniques are going to become more powerful and more accessible and cleaner. So I think for mushrooms, I would say after 5 years, I want to give it another 5 years, to be honest with you. I think it behooves in a private company like Silvan, it sort of behooves us to have an understanding of what's going on the cutting edge. But that doesn't mean we're going to use that technology to make new strains. We've had considerable success with conventional breeding, particularly Browns. It's almost like it's like a luxury at the moment, to be honest with you. But there'll come a time when it's important, but the time isn't now.
So you're keeping a watching brief on these
Yeah, I think so.
techniques.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, moving ahead with conventional, because there's no issue for that I issues with that. You're not going to get protests outside mushroom farms about mutant mushrooms, nothing like that.
No,
So
absolutely
are there any new white strains
not. I'd
on
leave
the
that,
horizon at the moment?
I've learned one thing. Is don't get ahead of your own salesman. So I would say we do have whites and browns in the pipeline, but I'd talk to Thomas in Sylvan, Australia about that. I'm probably the worst person to talk to because I'll create some sort of false hopes in our customer base. And I wouldn't want to do.
Fair enough, fair enough. Okay, well, thank you, Mark. It's an amazing and very complex and technical area, but one where we can make some pretty exciting changes. Okay,
All right.
thanks, Mark. That was really good.
Thank you.